Save big on everything when you shop at Menards. Upgrade your kitchen today with Clearview Cabinetry. We offer a great selection of finishes made with the finest materials and built to withstand life's sticky messes. They provide features like soft closed doors and drawers and with cabinet accessories to match your unique style. View our selection of Clearview Cabinetry on Menards.com. Plus, check out our weekly flyer and find plenty of great deals happening this week. Save big money
at Menards. Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 116 of the History Hotline. My name is Deanna Lincook, and as always, I'll be your host today.
Today, we are joined by a very special guest on the History Hotline podcast. And I am really excited, actually, to do this episode. It's going to be, I think, a little bit different from episodes you're used to, that where we focus maybe loads on the element of the Caribbean that is the history or Black British history. And we're going to think a little bit more about storytelling today, which I am very excited. From the Parabiti podcast, we have Rafiki. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I'm really happy to be here. I think this is my second UK collab, so I'm, nice. I'm really excited about that.
Welcome. And if you can't hear, he's from America.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Thank you once again, guys. Thank you for having me on this podcast. A little about me. I'm originally from Brooklyn, New York. My family is from the West Indies, with that being Guyana and Grenada, respectfully. And if you know Grenada really well, then really my family's from Caracou. Most Caribbean people do not know Caracou. Caracou is very, very small. But I would say it's very important to the general Caribbean story, especially when we talk about culture. I'm a writer. I graduated from Georgia State University with an English degree, and I have used that to inform a lot of my creative writing, which is focused on Caribbean culture and even broader African diaspora culture. In 2021, I published my novel Radiance Lost, and that was something I had written in high school. And now, being so much older, I am working on other stories inspired by Caribbean culture and Caribbean history. And my podcast, Power BT, is a Caribbean historical podcast, but it's also a storytelling podcast for those who like reading and writing. And it's focused on a tradition I hold very closely to my heart, and that is Caracou's big drum dance. So that's something I'll kind of be talking about a little bit today as we discuss broader Caribbean storytelling and the how culture is influenced by music, language, and religion as well, because those are things that I tend to focus on creatively.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for being here. I wonder, just because I like to break things down for my listeners, especially those that do not have roots in the Caribbean, do you want to talk about Caracou, Grenada, as quickly as you can? And as, I don't know if you can simplify it, but just for anyone that doesn't know the link.
I definitely will. I think that most people, when they think of the Caribbean, they think of just giant islands or one island. And you have a few. I mean, you have the Bahamas, which is a load of different islands. And you have Trinidad and Tobago. You know, you have St. Kitts and Nevis, so on and so forth. But Grenada is three islands. So you have Grenada, you have Caracou, and you have Petite Martinique. Most often, Caracou and Petite Martinique are labeled as more of a community as opposed to Grenada. Grenada is the largest island of the tri-island state, and that is why the country has been named after this larger island. And when we talk about Caracou as opposed to Grenada, they have a distinct cultural history.
But Grenada was colonized by the British.
It was colonized by it was colonized by the Spanish first. So yeah. Hence the name Grenada. You know, Colombia used to be called Granada. So right. People will hear Grenada and think I'm saying it wrong.
Right,
and then
yes.
Tell me it's Granada. And I'm like, no, it's Grenada. You know, but then the longest colonial rule was by the French. And yeah. This is actually where a lot of my research is focused on, because Grenada, like Dominica, has two languages or two creoles. You have the Grenadian French Creole, and you have the Grenadian English Creole, with the latter being spoken today. And so for the, I think it was about 100 years that the French ruled Grenada, there became an established French Creole, which with a lot of similarities to St. Lucian Creole, Haitian Creole, so on and so forth. But the unique thing about this Creole is, because Grenada is so far from the other Francophone islands, the dialect is distinct. So even the word Creole in the Grenadian dialect would just be kale. The R would be dropped. Okay. And that is an example of how the language has been not, well, I say evolved, because Trinidad also spoke a French Creole, but that died out very quickly. Mm. And so once it was not spoken anymore, Grenada had no necessarily means to continue speaking this language, specifically in the early 1900s with the switch of colonial rule and the unfortunate pressure from Grenadians themselves to give up the French Creole language. And now it's spoken by less than 1% of the population. It will unfortunately likely be extinct in the coming decades as older people pass away. Mm. But yeah, we've exchanged hands between the European powers over the course of centuries.
Yeah, definitely. And it's always interesting how they leave that lasting mark on language. I also wondered, and this is just revelatory to me, because this is why you need to talk to people that are not just Jamaican, Deanna, because you learn about other islands, and other islands are important, even though they are not in this country in as big as numbers. But I think, as is tradition on this podcast, when I have a guest, I do have some quick questions that I want to ask you. Maybe this will allow us to delve a little bit more into some Caribbean history. Maybe it won't, and that's okay. But I wondered if you would play along with the quick fire question game. So the first question I have for you is, and they're all historical, it's not a quiz, don't worry, it's all your opinion. If you had to pick a favorite historical time period to study or you know, just to look at, what would that be? What's your favorite time? And that can be in any country. You can't specify.
In any country.
Yeah.
Honestly, I would want to study maybe the process of the slave trade in Brazil.
Okay.
And nice. I only say that because Brazil has the largest amount of enslaved Africans taken to that country. Brazil is very black, with a lot of them coming from, you know, Nigeria. But I would definitely study Brazil and its colonial history, especially because my cousin is very focused on that kind of study.
Yeah, absolutely. And then is there a historical figure, an individual, wherever they come from, that you'd say is your favorite
or an inspiration to you? Definitely. And wow. I wouldn't have, I mean, I feel like at first my answer would have been Malcolm X. I mean, mm-hmm. but not only because of his presence in America, but his mother is from Grenada. So nice. I like to say immediate cousin.
Yeah.
but my favorite historical figure as of this point is actually Winston Fleury.
Okay.
And he passed away in 2019, and he's credited with bringing Karakou's big drum tradition and cultural history to the broader world. And he performed it for the Queen of England, I think, in the 1900s. And he helped Alan Lomax, a famous American ethnomusicologist, record these songs. And without these recordings, I would not know nearly as much about Karakou's big drum dance as, you know, I would like to. And there's so much that I still will not know because everything has not been recorded, even though this religious and cultural tradition has been preserved orally for hundreds of years. That language change from the French Creole to English Creole simply has destroyed so much. And so I attribute a lot of my work to Winston Fleury, and he's definitely someone I wish I could have spoken to. I actually think I crossed paths with him because he is at every big drum ceremony in Karakou.
Yeah.
And when I went in 2019, he was likely there, but I did not know who to look for, know who he was. But to think that I could have had a conversation with him before he passed away just breaks my heart sometimes.
Oh, no, I can imagine. Definitely, it's a kind of a bittersweet moment, I guess, but the fact that, you know, you shared a space and a presence with him as well is something to take. And I'm going to ask you more about Karakou's big drum dance shortly, but we've got to finish these questions first. My third question, it might also speak to your second question, just because I'm sure that not many people will know Winston Fleury, but is there someone that you wish whether that be your favorite or someone that you really admire historically that you wish more people knew about, and you've got this time to tell them?
I feel like my pick, I feel like most people know about her already. I mean, Toni Morrison, I
think
she's everywhere. But even actually a better figure would be Ama Ata Ado. She was a Ghanaian writer and thinker and teacher and so on. She actually recently
passed away.
In June. And when I had seen her, I saw her a video of her like maybe years ago when I was in high school, and she was talking about just the effects of colonialism and the unequal trade that Africa has suffered from European, you know, commerce and things like that. And I don't know that much about her, but just hearing her speak and listening to her voice, and hearing her thoughts and ideas, that's someone I am working on learning more about, and I would like others to learn more about as well.
Brilliant. Thank you for sharing that. And then what are you reading currently?
So, great question. I'm currently reading Vagabonds by Elogosa Osunde.
Nice.
She is a Nigerian writer. She's also, I think, staffed by the Paris Review right now. And I stumbled upon her last year in my, one of my English classes in my final year of school.
Yeah.
Called Good Boy. And it was part of a larger collection of like critically acclaimed writers. And that book was about being gay in Nigeria and how a little boy was kicked out and he grew up to be a business mogul. And in line with that first book I read, which as a queer person myself, like really just touched my heart. I'm reading Vagabonds, and Vagabonds is it's a magical, realistic book. And it is a theme with not just being gay in Nigeria, but being queer in general in the larger African context. And I just think it was something I wanted to read for Pride Month, especially given the recent sanctions in Ghana and especially Uganda for queer individuals. So that's currently what I'm digesting right now.
Nice. And a final question. And based on past episodes, I think that I know what you're going to say, but you might not. If there was a book that you think everybody should read, or you'd recommend that you think everybody should have in their library at least, what would that be?
Well, it's going to be my book. I mean, if it's not my book, not Radiance Lost.
There we go.
Find on Amazon.
Say that again. Give us the title again.
Love Radiance Lost.
There we go.
So if it's not that book, I definitely would nominate. I mean, oh my God, it would be several. I mean, American Street by Ibi Zoboye, Haitian author.
Yeah.
You Have Good Boy by Elogosa Osunde, Nigerian author. Even Vagabonds. I just started that book today on my train ride today, and I'm already recommending it.
Nice.
So plenty. I have given you four.
There we go. More than I could have asked for. Absolutely. And I will put the link to your book in the show notes as well. So if you are interested in reading that, then you can do that. Just check the show notes and check social media as well when this episode is out. So back to the big drum dance. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about that and how your work intercepts with all of that?
You know, I definitely will. I love talking about this. I think that I want to start by saying that for me, like, to study this part of history, I had to open my mind up to, I guess, ideas about like faith and like religion and things like that. And I think that here in the States, there's a lot of movement towards abandoning the church. And I wasn't raised religiously at all. But I've seen one of the first podcasts I listened to was talking about Black Southern culture and specifically Black Southern religion and how it has informed, you know, broader Black identities within the church, outside of the church, and, you know, historical and cultural stories. And that is kind of what inspired me to learn more about Caribbean, like, in religion in the Anglophone islands. And so when I went to Karaku, I was taken, I think, you know, it was a graduation trip for me and my family. I'm a triplet, so I have two other brothers, and I also have a younger sister.
Oh, cool.
So it was our first time in Karaku. My mom hadn't been in 20 years. And I preface this by saying my mom was not born there. She was born in Brooklyn like me. But her parents were very big on keeping that cultural connection alive. I mean, she wasn't even allowed to play with people who were not West Indian. It was that serious. Right. And I have many problems with that. But it did allow for me to be more in touch with this side of my family. And so when we went to Karaku, my mom had told me about Big Drum and the Tombstone Feast. And essentially, the Big Drum Dance is a, I don't even know how to describe it. It is a Afro-Caribbean religion in Karaku. So even though Karaku is a part of Grenada and so is Petite Martinique, it's only really done in Karaku with maybe Petite Martinique as well. And essentially, it is, people will look at it as a cultural practice, but it is religious. And at one point had a lot of religious meaning. People would do it to call rain. it's done for when people pass away, for their spirits to move on, and not directly after they die, but maybe a year or two or three years later. It is also done when people build a house to bless the land, and it is done when the ancestors, or the old parents, as we say, come to you in a dream and essentially say that you must, they must be fed, they must be taken care of. And it's as there's a woman who was interviewed in these recordings done by Alan Lomax in the 1950s, and her name is Mary Fortune. And she goes into detail about the Big Drum Dance and about what accompanies it, which is called the Tombstone Feast. So there's like a bunch of different foods that are cooked, cuckoo, rice, okra, vegetables, which would be kalalu, and provisions, which are potatoes. You have pork, chicken, mutton, and these things are prepared in a certain way and put on a table, and it's called the old parents' plate. And essentially, in the context of someone dying, the host family, so the family who has lost a member, they would host this at their house, and the food would be prepared, people would be in the room, and they will leave the room and not look back, and it is said that the old parents come and accept the food. So I like to talk about the practice in the context of death, not because I like to talk about people dying, but I think that when people associate religions, they mark them as being formal depending on what they are done and what they're used for. And so Karaku's Big Drum Dance is very small because the island itself is very small, but it's unique because it has enabled us outside of a religious context to trace ourselves to many different African groups. We know our genetic history based on this oral tradition. So we have what are called nations. And you will find in other religions, especially like I like to use Haitian Vodun as an example, that there are nations, and these nations inform people's understanding of themselves and of the spirits that they may or may not worship. So because Karaku is such a small place and colonial rules on religion, a lot has been lost in comparison to Haitian Vodun. But we do have these nations, and these nations consist of the Cromanti, which are Akan and Ashanti groups from West Africa. Many people know the Cromanti, especially being Jamaican. You definitely know the Cromanti with Queen Nani and, you know, all these different people. Cujo, that's a famous Akan name. We also have the Igbo. So Igbo people from Nigeria, we have them as well. We have the Moko, the Manding, which might also be called Mandinka. We have the Chamba, the Banda, the Congo with a K. And then we also have the Temne. Temne is very unique because they're a very, very small ethnic group only found within Sierra Leone. And we are the only place in the whole of the Americas, including the Caribbean, to have a strong connection to Temne people, where Temne culture has not only been found but been preserved to this day and age. And we actually have connections, like events will be had between Karaku and Sierra Leone, where the Temne people will come from Sierra Leone and visit Karaku and see how people have lived and held on to different cultures. Actually, another name for the whole tradition is Saraka, or some might say that Saraka is only reserved to the actual feast, similar to like the Tombstone Feast. And that word is said to be attributed to Sierra Leonean languages. So while the exact origins of where we get certain things are hard to pinpoint because African cultures share so many similarities with one another, those are some of the nations that we have. We also have the Arata, and I forgot to mention them. The Arata, that is actually one of the old names for the capital of what is now Benin. But the Arata people are really Fon and Ewe groups from West Africa. And so these nations inform the broader context of Karaku's Big Drum Dance and cultural and ancestral history. And when people do the Big Drum Dance, they're doing it to celebrate their ancestors who have survived the horrors of transatlantic slavery and settled by force or by choice in Karaku.
Nice. Brilliant. That is so fascinating. And something that I didn't know much about. I do wonder, how then, I'm thinking about colonization. How did a tradition like this that's so rooted in different African belief systems that, you know, Christianity came in through colonization into the Caribbean to try and, you know, civilize these savage people, and you can't see me, but I'm doing air quotes, of course. How does a tradition like this survive attempts to colonize it, and are there, I don't know, direct attacks on it, and yeah, how does it still kind of prevail to the point where you're speaking about it to me today?
So I think that it's a complicated question because people have ideas, but no one might really know.
Okay.
But I think the biggest part is the fact that when you see religions like Haitian Vodou, you have an obvious element, which is possession. So mm-hmm. people are being mounted by Lawas, and those are the spirits in the Haitian language.
Right.
But Karakou does not have this element. And so
okay.
when you, as a European person, are seeing people sing and dance, you might not necessarily want them to congregate, but that fear of African religion mobilizing people to revolt is not there because there is no
right.
possession. And
okay.
I think in my personal understanding of how African religions have been viewed by European people,
mm-hmm.
possession was a big thing. And that is why, unfortunately, Karakou's big drum dance is not always seen as a religion. It is seen as simply a thing. People in Karakou will literally say, we do this because we are African, and that is it. So, and then in the modern time we live in, the ideas behind religion, as people abandon religions for various reasons, that is reinforced. But another reason I believe that it has survived is simply because of the remoteness of Karakou. You had Grenada, and at one point there was the revolution with Fedon, and I have researched it, but I don't know enough about it to speak on it with absolute certainty in terms of chronological events in that revolution. But
absolutely,
that with Fedon came about and likely distracted the French at the time from things going on in Karakou, because Karakou
okay.
is just so much smaller. You also have Karakou is very mountainous, but there's not necessarily the ability to maroon, aka run away, and establish your own communities. While the big drum dance is done at maroons, our use of that word is more so for a festival. It's not to describe a person who has escaped, as it would be in Jamaica or even in Suriname, and so on and so
right.
forth. But I think the biggest thing is the lack of possession and obvious like spiritual mounting and things like that in the big drum dance. There's a teacher, her name is Lorna McDaniel, and she actually went from America to Karakou, I think recently after the Cuban situation with Grenada, to study the big drum dance. And she had, in her research, developed what looks like it was a pantheon of non-ancestral spirits, but spirits that would have come from African religions, and kind of re-emphasized the religious importance of the tradition as it may have looked in one point in time. But I think that those big things, kind of letting go of certain elements, of course, on top of the practice of the tradition at night. So you'll see in a lot of stories about plantations in the Caribbean, like the enslaved Africans are working things up at night. The Haitian Revolution was like done at night, and all these different things. So the big drum dance is usually done at night, and it actually lasts all night up until the next day. So I think that all these different reasons are how the religion survived, as well as the perseverance of our ancestors, but also by luck. You know, when we think of the conscious and critical movements Europeans did to destroy Black cultures and communities and all these different things, it is really by luck sometimes that things still exist and survive.
No, absolutely. That makes complete sense. And so you spoke about the ethnographer that was kind of
yes.
that had collated the recordings and the kind of things that you're using to kind of, I guess, map out these histories and get a bit better understanding of it. It is an interesting way of conducting history, especially when we're looking at groups of people who often fall victim to the records about their lives and their histories being destroyed by colonial powers. So what's that process been like for you, or if you want to speak more about the process of the kind of initial collating of those histories and those stories?
Well, I would say that it has been difficult
yeah.
because, you know, I was depending on like a YouTube channel, which I just found posting these songs
yeah.
and there's someone who they know, they seem to understand the Grenadian patois, as we would call it, the French Creole.
Yeah.
They seem to understand it, and they are able to translate some songs. But my attempts to connect with them have been shot down for whatever reason. I mean, I'm
yeah.
the only person watching the videos. I don't understand why. If they talk about, I'm very frustrated because they talk about preserving the language specifically, right, and spreading the music and stuff like that, but they do not want to communicate with those who are interested. So that is a point of frustration. I have been using, unfortunately, Google Translate, like with Haitian Creole, and translating what I can from that Haitian Creole to English. But there's that dialectal difference, which does come up. There are words and phrases that are used in both. So Bagade is don't look in Haitian Creole. It is the same in, you know, Grenadian Patois. But of course you have words that are loan words from different African languages that I've had to piece together. So my understanding of which nations are the most prominent on the island or in the tradition. So those would be the Cro-Monte, the Igbo, some would say the Temne. I honestly would disagree. I think it would be the Cro-Monte, the Igbo, the Arada, and the Congo. And so whatever languages are available in terms of translation, I will translate and see what words I can get. Luckily enough, because of the organization of the nations, a lot of songs are attributed to nations, which is how we know these nations existed. And then you even have songs that are for, not nations specifically, but for dances. So there are halichords, which the women will dance in a certain way. There's the bel kawe, which has like influences of African dance and European dances, specifically like the quadrille. And then you have frivolous dances, you have like bongo dances. And it's interesting because while a lot of what I've discussed on this religion has been informed by, you know, Africa's history and culture, these songs also informs what is now soca music because of the political commentary and cultural commentary of these people, of our people, on plantations and in little villages and things like that. I mean, there's one song about this man or woman crying because his children and his wife are being sold to Haiti. There's another song about, it's called Lajan Lajan, which is money, money. And this woman is basically saying that had she known that men from Dominica would be so rich, she would have gone and married one because her sister married one first. And it's just very interesting because when people, once again, when you think about religion and use Christianity and Abrahamic religions as an idea, people think that it has to be obviously talking about God. And when you find it in indigenous cultures and African cultures, that's usually not the case. You know, one of the Cro-Monte songs is called Negla Wive, which simply means the black man arrives, the man arrives. And it's attributed to the Cro-Monte. So with those just simple ideas, what is the song about? Is it about Cro-Monte people arriving? And in what form are they arriving? Are they arriving as slaves? Are they arriving off of a boat? I mean, and that's really kind of the creative process starts for me in terms of writing short stories inspired by each of these songs, whether they come from a nation or not. So when I am writing a story inspired by this, like I am looking at the research done by myself and by Lorna McDaniel, by Winston Fleury, and I don't want their work to simply die. So there's been, in terms of Lorna's research, an understanding that there are spirits from Africa that have been brought to Karakou that might not be worshipped, but their names are pronounced. So Anansi would be one. Everyone knows about the Anansi stories. So people look at him as just a folk character, but one of our songs, actually the very first song we sing, is called Anansi O Sari Baba. And while the words are no longer clearly translated, the meaning is it is a prayer, it is a beg pardon song. And that is to pray for forgiveness for the sins of the community. And when people sing the song, they'll pour libations, they'll throw rice on the ground and things like that. And that essentially starts the big drum dance. But then you also have Oko. So those who practice Yoruba religion know of Oko to be an Orisha, and he's worshipped in Brazil, he's worshipped in Nigeria, so on and so forth. However, in Karakou, the song we have for Oko is Oko Mama Mwen Padane Mwen, which is Oko, my mother, pardon me. And that kind of might confuse people because Oko is a man, but in Karakou, for whatever reason, Oko has become a woman. And we see this in Louisiana with the corruption of Anansi to Aunt Nancy. So it kind of shows the cultural changes. There are other mentions of different African spirits, such as Damala, which you would see in Haiti, and that comes from Benin. He is the great serpent. you have Legba, and obviously everyone knows Papa Legba from Haitian Bodoun. Legba's also in West Africa's Benin once again. You have, who else? You have Mawulisa, once again from Benin. She is the, or they are the twin spirit that represents the sun and the moon. And if you've watched The Woman King, you see a reference to Mawulisa as well. And it's just very interesting to study Caribbean religion in Grenada and Kaku specifically, because Oko is a great example of a spirit who is Yoruba, but she is attributed to be with the Cromanti. Wow. Why would that be? It's because Kaku does not have a Yoruba nation. However, Grenada and Trinidad had a lot of Yoruba people be taken as indentured servants, so they were not technically slaves. Yeah. And a lot of the time they were taken from other Caribbean colonies and brought to those neighboring places.
Yeah.
And so Oko is an Orisha for fertility and for like agriculture and things like that. So when people from Kaku went to Trinidad and Grenada, they brought Oko back because Kaku is plagued by droughts. There are no major rivers on the island. So if you know Jamaica has a bunch of rivers, and these carry the island through the dry season and enable, you know, flora and fauna to survive. Kaku does not have that, which is why the big drum dance is also done to call rain. So when people from Kaku went to Grenada and they went to Trinidad and they see Yoruba indentured servants worshiping this spirit for, you know, help with their crops, they are going to take Oko and bring her to Kaku, but there's no Yoruba culture or context for them to put her in. So they will put her with the most dominant group on the island, which would be the Cromanti. So it this is why I'm interested in religion, because it informs culture and it informs society and so on and so forth. And then you have historical figures who were elevated to like a spiritual status. So you have Cromanti Kujo, and he is said to be a Jamaican Maroon who was taken from Jamaica all the way to Kaku. And he's one of the fathers of Big Drum. You have like Mama Nu, who's like essentially the mother of us all. Basically like a Mother Earth kind of idea. That's how I've interpreted it. And I know I've kind of gone on a tangent, because that's what I tend to do when I talk about this. But there's just so much intertwined information. Some things I cannot pull apart. For example, I know Legba is supposed to be with the Fon and Ewe groups based on my understanding of Vodun. But Legba has been associated with the Igbo people. Why? Because the dance for his song, which is Don Don Banan or Ibole Bole, the dance is identical to what is done for Legba in Haiti. But people in Kaku did not know this, even though they know of Haiti. Alan Lomax identified it because he had studied Haitian Vodun. And he told one of the performers, hey, is this a dance for Legba? And the dancer says, I don't know who Legba is. So it kind of shows the what has been lost, but in a way what has been preserved without us even being in contact with one another. It's very, very interesting.
Wow. No, definitely. And I think one of the interesting things you brought up there that you kind of brought back at the end was kind of the movement of people initially in between kind of Caribbean islands, which we don't often think about. Like, you guys won't know because you weren't in the last recording, but we spoke about movement of people migrating from the Caribbean to the US and Britain. But actually, the way that culture and traditions and religion and song travels around the Caribbean islands as well, in this context as well, to inform the big drum dances is really, really interesting. And the way those migrations were voluntary or from indentured people or from enslaved people and so forth. I wondered if you could touch on, and time is running out, and not just because I'm trying to keep the episodes to 30 minutes, as you true listeners will know, but also because my Zencastr subscription is running low. So Zencastr, if you're listening. But yeah, I just wanted to ask about kind of your storytelling and how that kind of is impacted maybe by the big drum dance, or if you want to speak about how it's impacted by, you know, your roots in the Caribbean more broadly and how you've kind of got into storytelling a little bit from your own background and family.
Well, I will say, like, I didn't grow up listening to a lot of maybe traditional Caribbean stories. I didn't grow up listening to like Anansi stories and things like that. But my mother, she's a woman of proverbs, and not in the biblical sense, but just because she makes them up as And I do the same thing. I love doing it. I think it's awesome. But I think that I was always very drawn to writing. And one day, you know, I think a famous Caribbean, you know, saying is, if you're bored, go read a book, go study a book, go write a book. I grew up hearing these things all the time.
Yeah.
And one day I was like, you know what? Fine. I will write a book. Why not? And I just wrote it initially about my siblings and I, informed by, like, you know, Caribbean culture. And the information of that is, as I am older now, is somewhat vague. I think that it was kind of the, you know, magical, fantastical idea behind it. And that's why I am so interested in Power BT, because Power BT is obviously informed by a very, very small religion, something that's not even recognized by the people who practice it necessarily. And that's why a lot of the stories can take turns between just being simply realistic and nothing magical about them to be being purely fantastical and made up. And that's kind of what I like. I think that studying Karakou's Big Drum Dance has taught me that, and studying history in general, I think, has taught me that there's a lot to be found in the mundane. Like, a lot of people will be like, oh, your family's from the Caribbean, that's so cool. You know, and I'm like, well, your family's from the South. What's the difference? If my family were farmers in the islands and your family are farmers in the South, they are doing the exact same thing.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, there's simply nothing. But granted, you think mine is cool because there's a distinction between the two. And I always tell people, that same excitement you see in farming in another country, look at that. Use that same excitement when you study farming in your own backyard.
Absolutely.
You know, so I'm just trying to take the mundane and make it magical, I guess. And I want to improve people's understanding of what Caribbean literature and Caribbean art looks like. I think a lot of it is focused on colonialism. And that's why I appreciate art like writers like Ibi Saboy, because she talks about being Haitian in America. She brings up the fact that a lot of people stuck at the border are Haitian. And I think this came to more common knowledge last year when people were talking about Haitian being whipped at the border. But 40% of people stuck at the American border are of Haitian lineage and descent. And, you know, as Black people in the States, we don't necessarily think about how immigration affects us, even when we are descended from migrants ourselves. But it reminds us that, yes, you know, migration and immigration issues are focused about around Latinos and things like that, and Haitians are Latinos, but a lot of Latinos are Black, and this makes migration and immigration issues a Black issue. And if we really believe in helping one another, then we need to be focused on, you know, that kind of issue. But, and that's kind of talking about how writing informs, you know, politics and your knowledge on world events. But in terms of just understanding writing from a consumer standpoint to simply enjoy it, I appreciate artists like Ibi Saboy because she destigmatizes Haitian vodou. Not in the sense where it's like, okay, this character does vote voodoo and woo-woo and all this other stuff, but simply when people see homeless people, she's like, oh, this isn't a homeless person. This is Papa Legba, and you shouldn't ignore him. You should talk to him. You should see what he needs, what is wrong. Because living in New York City, there are homeless people all about. How many times do you see a homeless person and you walk past them? But if you, in her sense, put a certain level of importance on this, it not only makes you communicate with them, it humanizes them. It gives you a reason to speak with them, and you recognize, wait a minute, this person is distinctly different than me, but they're a part of my community for whatever reason. And that's just me understanding American Street. I mean, me reading Vagabonds right now, it has that same level of magical realism set in Lagos, and it talks about how the corruption in Nigeria, how it's always watching you, and how the two gods aren't necessarily real Nigerian spirits, but they are the city, which is called, like, I think it's Eke or something, and then money, which is Owo. And it, I mean, think about it. You pay a lot of money to live in a city, and as expensive as the city bows to money, because if money is moved somewhere else, then the city will die, you know. And it's, and she talks about, you know, movement from traditional religions to Christianity, and just, there's just so much tied together. And I think that writing is supposed to remind people that nothing exists in a vacuum. That's something I say every day, all the time. And as much as we believe we can separate and compartmentalize, you know, the things we experience and how other people's experiences affect us, sometimes you simply cannot. And it doesn't mean that you have no power or you cannot navigate the situation. But I think it gives you a better understanding of who and what you're dealing with.
Absolutely, definitely. And your stories really do encompass that, I would say, from the ones I've heard from Parabiti. And I would urge anybody that has listened to this episode and enjoys it and wants to learn more about Rafiki's storytelling and about the Caribbean a little bit more broadly, you should definitely listen to his podcast, and that will be in the show notes and linked below, because I think it would be a really, really nice podcast. And I think, you know, I wanted to have you on this podcast as well, not just for this conversation and for how fruitful it's been, but also to introduce you to the audience that I have and that listen to me weekly, because I just think there is just so much, a wealth of storytelling and information on your channel that people over here will find super, super interesting as well. So yeah, please continue doing the work that you currently do, and if you need more information on anything that Rafiki's doing, his socials will be linked below. But I thought we'd leave, if you wanted to share anything you're working on currently, or you wanted to shout any work out that you've done in the past that you'd like supporting, that can also be linked as well, and my listeners can join.
I would say the only thing I'm focused on right now is PowerBT. I think there's some things I want to work on, but you know, writing takes time, and right. So I'm just trying to be patient with myself. And I am posting weekly as often as I can. Sometimes it might be 2 weeks, so if you see a gap,
mind your business. Why.
Yeah, mind your business. Also, I will say episode 5 is kind of the introduction into Karakou's Big Drum Dance in a more detailed way. The first few episodes are just, you know, stories I've written, stories I wanted to share, to see how people thought about listening to narrated stories. But PowerBT is my big focus right now, and when the podcast is done, when I finish each collection, so a collection is an assortment of stories focused on like a nation with different songs or even dances with different songs. Once I finish that, my goal is to make these short stories into an anthology. It'll be a book, a collection of short stories, maybe not all of them, but quite a few of them. So PowerBT will eventually, God willing, have a published form. But I just encourage you all to look up Karakou's Big Drum Dance. You can look up like Alan Lomax recordings of it and listen to them. You can even find it on Apple Music and Spotify. It is actually quite crazy. But I have been trying to organize it and put it into a palatable way for this podcast, because unfortunately with things like history, you know, and changes, and especially Black history, some of it is up to speculation. Yeah. And I encourage you all to not get caught up in pseudoscience or pseudo stories about who we are and what we've done. Right. I find that to be very detrimental to our understanding of ourselves and our understandings of other communities and people. So, yeah, that's just my final message here on the History Hotline. Thank you for having me.
No, thank you for being here. And I say also, it's my favorite story, I think, Old Man Perry. I really like that one. I know it's like the first one, but I've listened to it so many times. Like, it entertains me so much. I love it. It's just the cantankerous nature of his character. It makes me laugh. So yeah, there's a wealth of stories for you to have a listen to. So yeah, do tune into that. Thank you so much for listening. And thank you, Rafiki, for being on the podcast today.
Thank you for having me.
No worries. Right.